This is an NPR News special. I'm Jennifer Ludden in Washington. This week, the world lost an impassioned defender of freedom, human rights, human dignity, and peace, Nelson Mandela. He was heralded internationally as a great statesman and an icon of courage. Mandela's journey from freedom fighter to prisoner to president of South Africa capped a half century of struggle against white rule and the institution of apartheid. Apartheid went far beyond mere segregation. Under the program created by South Africa's National Party in the 1950s, each race would be confined to its own area, with whites controlling the vast majority of the country and blacks relegated to their demarcated homelands. It was against this landscape that Nelson Mandela and his comrades began their push to break the white domination of the country. In Mandela, an audio history, producers Joe Richman and Sue Johnson of Radio Diaries explore the struggle against apartheid through rare sound recordings of Mandela, as well as those who fought with him and against him.
The program that follows is about the people of South Africa.
1935, 1940, 1945. A nation develops into the premier industrial power on the African continent.
The Golden City, South Africa's Johannesburg. Millions of pounds worth of gold comes out of Joburg each year. With this wealth, the people of the city live well and happily. Truly, this is the finest of all the world's golden cities.
As a white citizen, you had social status, you had beautiful schools, you had parks, you had everything that you desire, and you had the highest standard of living in the world. Blacks were just pushed out.
The population of South Africa was about 10 million. 2 million and a bit were whites and dominated everything. And there were gold mines and diamond mines with huge economic potential based on very cheap black labor.
It was a master-servant relationship. We had domestic staff who were black, but they lived in their own quarters. They were the nannies and the cleaners and the gardeners.
We were taught that the whites were superior people. And we were told when we were young that if you do good in this life, your next life will become better. And I remember promising myself that I'm going to be a good little boy so that my next life I wanted to be a white person. That was my goal in life. And I determined to be a good boy.
We come from far away places.
By 1940, I mean, you had this flood of people coming into the cities. And Mandela went to Johannesburg to work.
Lord, make us one.
I remember when I arrived in Johannesburg in the early 40s, the fear, you know, of the power of the white man inhibited us a great deal. And the government was becoming very tough.
News from Government House Pretoria, where South Africa's newly elected Prime Minister, Dr. Malan, was sworn in at the beginning of a new chapter in South Africa's history.
At the time of the 1948 elections, the Nationalist Party under D.F. Malan preached what they called Baaskap. Baaskap is an Afrikaans word to express white domination.
The color question is rapidly increasing in seriousness and urgency. I consider apartheid, that's the separation policy, to be South Africa's last chance to remain a white man's country.
Well, the appeal was survival. The appeal was we are a small minority on a black continent, and we number so many millions, and the black number X times that millions. And if we are to survive in Africa, and here we are, and we've been here since 1652, we have got to survive. And the way to survive is to maintain domination. Simple as that.
I remember I came out of Park Station that morning and bought a newspaper and learned that the National Party had won. And Comrade Oliver Tambo said, well, I like this because we now know that we have an enemy in power And I think that we're going to have a better opportunity of mobilizing our people. So when they came into power, it became clear that we were going to be put under a very severe test.
In these circumstances, the government has decided on the following measures. A prohibition on meetings has been...
And immediately after 1948, the apartheid government announced that it was introducing a new series of laws.
The Group Areas Act. There was an Immorality Act so that you couldn't have sexual relations across the colour line. Race classification, which laid down for all time your colour and your category, white, coloured, Indian or black. So all these things came in one after the other.
The coloured man must always carry these passes.
Photographs are taken at the offices of the Department of Native Affairs. Daily, a large number turns up here for reference books. Each book contains the photograph of the owner, his name, race, and particulars of employment.
They use this crude method of putting a pencil through your hair. If the pencil sticks, then you are black or African. If it falls off, you've got a chance of being classified coloured.
Naturally, the officials who are employed here must have a thorough knowledge of Bantu customs and languages.
Each time you left your home, you had to make sure that you have a little book in your pocket. And if you didn't have that piece of paper, some ignorant, stupid youngster in the police force could stop you and demand that you identify yourself. If you couldn't, they locked you up.
At 9 o'clock, a big bell would ring, dong, dong, and you knew that was for you, if you were black, to get out of the white city.
Dr. Malanu nomthetho nzima. Dr. Malanu nomthetho nzima. Dr. Malan has got very strange rules. He's stopping me from doing that and this and the other in my own land. And people in the street would start singing, Dr. Malanu nomthetho nzima. Andazuguba soshona pi.
In the 50s, the apartheid structure was tightening. Situation was becoming so much worse, you know.
And as Uguba Soshona P.
The communities, they'd been intimidated, cowed down, but we knew the feeling among the vast majority of the people was that this system cannot continue and must do something about it.
In Johannesburg, premier city of South Africa, there was staged last weekend the first move in a campaign that may lead to civil disobedience. Thousands of coloured people went to attend a protest meeting called by the African National Congress. This is the most important African organisation in the Union, and it called on all coloured people to protest against the racial segregation laws. A crowd of some thousands made their way to the meeting.
We now began to feel that the time had come for the emergence of a mass organisation to go out into the highways and organize the masses of the people.
You needed somebody to lead the people. You needed somebody who could make the people believe in the organization. Mandela had what it took to actually be out there in the front, leading the movement.
Since then, the Congress leaders have announced that they will decide later this month whether to launch a civil disobedience campaign. This would urge all coloured people to break the unjust laws and to court arrest.
The first thing we did was the Defiance Campaign of 1952, when the ANC decided that all the unjust laws would simply be broken. You know, to be part of that kind of movement, to defy the laws and be arrested, and Christ, I mean, it was exciting. We knew that we could do something.
And for 8,500 people to be arrested at the time in 1952 was no small achievement. The mood had been created that our struggle was reaching a dimension where it could not be crushed.
In 1960, on the 21st of March, the PAC, Pan-African Congress, made preparations to launch an anti-pass campaign.
So on this particular day, word went out that all pass books must be burnt, to actually light up these passes and burn them. The slogan was, away with the passes. The atmosphere was electric, you know, to join in the bonfire, you know. I remember that vividly. You know, as a kid, you know, you always love to see fire, you know. It was fun, I mean. But of course, later in the day, we heard news came over the radio.
Here is a special announcement. The Governor General has proclaimed a state of emergency in about 80 of the 300 magisterial districts of the U.S.
Several hundred natives gathered peaceably to protest the pass laws. Police mounted on tanks opened fire. 69 natives were killed, 176 wounded. Most of the victims were shot in the back. Some of the dead were children, women, and elderly men.
Here were people just marching to the police station to hand over a passbook, and the police opened fire on them. For the first time, it showed the world how brutal the apartheid system could be.
The Prime Minister assured the country that law and order would be maintained. If necessary, the Defence Force would be called in.
There was a mood among people following the Sharpeville massacre that we had to start dealing with the armed forces of the state, the armed might of the apartheid state.
Mr. Mandela then made a statement saying, how do we combat such a brutal foe? We must consider other methods, other means. And the other methods, the other means was violence. We felt, you know, it just cannot continue.
When we return, rare recordings of Nelson Mandela during his underground struggle against apartheid. You're listening to an NPR News special, Remembering the Life of Nelson Mandela. One of the greatest leaders of the 20th century has died, Nelson Mandela. We're remembering him today through an audio history of the struggle against apartheid, South Africa's system of racial separation begun in the 1950s. South Africa's white minority government tried to crush the struggle, which forced the movement underground.
A remarkable demonstration by a crowd of several hundred outside the courthouse in Pretoria. Nelson Mandela, leader and founder of the sabotage movement Spear of the Nation and a leading member of African National Congress, accused, with the others, of plotting sabotage to overthrow the South African government by force.
There were eight of us in the trial. And the first day, the lawyer said, chaps, prepare for the worst.
Firstly, the state alleges the planned purpose thereof was to bring about chaos, disorder and turmoil in the battle to be waged against the white man in this country.
They were called terrorists. We knew that there was no hope of getting an acquittal. The question was, what do we do with a trial?
When the defense case started, Mandela, he was going to be the first defense witness. And the prosecution had prepared extensively to cross-examine Mandela and break him down. And they all got a shock when our lawyers announced that Mandela will not give evidence, but he'll make a statement from the dock.
The courtroom was absolutely packed. He stood up and he proceeded to deliver the speech.
I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. I know this sounds revolutionary to the white in this country because the majority of voters will be Africans. This makes the white man fear democracy.
That was a four-hour speech.
And I have.
But that last bit where he said, these are the ideas for which I'm prepared to die. Just that last bit.
I knew what he was going to say because we'd all seen the speech. Everybody had made comments about it. And I knew he was going to say, in effect, hang me if you dare to, Mr. Judge. But only when he said it.
I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
There was dead silence. Nobody said anything. Even the judge didn't know what to say. I knew it was a moment of history. He emerged then as a great leader.
Yes, Your Lord. Very well, the court will then adjourn.
The possibility of a death sentence, of course, worried me. And I remember we adjourned for lunch. It was a very hot day, and a friendly African warder asked me the question, Mandela, what do you think is going to happen to you in this case? I said to him, they are going to hang us. Now, I was really expecting some word of encouragement from him, and I thought he was going to say, Manisi, that can never happen. But he became serious, and then he said, I think you're right, they're going to hang you.
The next day, armed police massed in even greater force as Mr. Justice De Wet was passing sentence.
I am by no means convinced that the motive of the accused were as altruistic as they wished the court to believe.
When they said, stand up for your sentence, we thought, well, here it comes.
I have decided not to impose the supreme penalty, which in a case like this would usually be the proper penalty for the crime. That is the only leniency I can show. The sentence in the case of all the accused will be one of life imprisonment.
And we laughed. We turned to each other and laughed because we expected to be hanged.
At the back entrance to the Pretoria Court, large crowds gather to watch the accused being driven away to start their life sentences.
There have been growing protests from all over the world today, but the sentence of life imprisonment passed in South Africa on this man, Nelson Mandela.
As we're being flown to Robben Island, one tried to accept the reality that we may, in fact, spend years in prison. But we believed very strongly that we would not die in jail. We would return. But we stayed there for 27 years.
This is the site of South Africa's top security jail, Robben Island, a narrow pencil of land off Cape Town, 7 miles out in the South Atlantic. These watchtowers stand guard over men who millions of black South Africans regard as their government in exile.
We landed at Robben Island. There's big iron gates, and every gate bangs behind me. Bangs behind me. And then the warder opened one of the doors of the cell, wooden doors, and then he opened the grill and he just shoved me. And there was my bucket and a couple of blankets. And that was my first night.
We worked at the lime quarry. We'd never done pick and shovel work before. So every day we had bleeding hands and blisters. Very, very hot. When we started working there, we were told that we'd work there for 6 months. We, in fact, worked there for about 13 years.
In the lime quarry, most of the time you're leaning on your
shovel or your pickaxe, but all of the time you are in a group of people discussing things.
I mean, every single man on the island was a book, so to speak, and you could really learn from each one of them.
Our universe were 30 people. We were completely isolated.
They put us into a section on the island called the Terrorist Camp. And we were called the Terries. Nelson Mandela, Walter Sisulu, people that they identified as leaders.
It was, to a very large extent, a mistake for the regime to bring us together. In spite of the fact that we're in prison, we were able to stand away from ourselves and to discover the weaknesses and the mistakes that we made in the course of our struggle.
People would say that life in prison is very tedious, but nobody wandered around bored, doing nothing. And if I wanted to see you, I needed to make an appointment with you. Can you believe that in prison I have to make an appointment to see somebody when I'm locked up with you for 24 hours a day? And people were pretty strict about it. I couldn't go up to somebody and say, okay, can we have a chat about this? No, we can't. I'm booked. But I ended up being like that because if you didn't have appointments, your life would have been unstructured and meaningless.
Asikatali no mabespopa sizimisele inkululeko.
My family lived under very difficult conditions without a head of the family who could support them, give them the love and the security which they deserved.
My name is Zinzi Mandela. When my father went to prison, I was 18 months old. So I think I was about 13, 14 when I saw him for the first time.
The following rules are applicable to all visitors to Robben Island. No parcels or articles.
I thought he would hold me, you know. I thought he would lift me in the air, you know, maybe spin me around. But obviously that didn't happen. The reality was that I had to see him behind this glass partition, and we spoke through a telephone. There were warders on either side of us, interrupting the conversation and saying, you cannot speak about that. Whose name is that? You cannot talk about that person. For many years, I never saw my father standing, because he would walk in there and find him seated already. So I had no idea even how tall he was. For him, it can't have been easy.
Well, I think in the nature of the apartheid system, they had no option but to bury us alive. No newspaper was allowed to publish a photograph of a prisoner. They hoped that way the public would simply forget us.
Cape Town glowed in warm, sunny weather today for one of its most colourful ceremonies, the opening of Parliament. It was opened at noon by the President, Mr. Fouché.
The Republic has enjoyed a year of peace and tranquility.
All political movements were banned. Everything was quiet, ostensibly. In terms of the struggle, we were in the doldrums.
Protest, agitation completely died out. And yet, under the surface, it continued to bubble.
They had locked up Mandela in jail, but they hadn't looked around to say, where are their children and what are they doing?
The student movement and the leadership of people like Steve Biko, there arose a group imbued with the spirit of black consciousness.
The reaction of the older generation to us was, are you guys mad? Those guys are going to come blow you away. They're going to kill you. And we said, no. First thing is you stand up and speak your mind, as any normal human being has the right to do.
You could feel it. You could feel that something had to give. It happened on June the 16th.
Teach yourself Afrikaans.
Good evening, listeners.
Let us start off by getting to know all the Afrikaans sounds. Lach, dach, en nach.
Afrikaans is a hybridization, if you like, of Dutch.
Dach en nach.
Thank you. Easy, isn't it?
It's a language that was used by the rulers. And the black children hated Afrikaans with a passion.
1975, and Afrikaans is exactly 100 years old. To pay homage to the Afrikaans language, pupils of the school present a play in Afrikaans.
Every school day began with an assembly of all the kids. And one day there's an announcement.
I'm going to speak to you about Bantu education, the education of 1 million Bantu children.
As of today, every subject would be taught in Afrikaans. And the teacher walks in, history becomes geskiedenis. And we're all like, what are you talking about? He says, I don't know either. And that didn't work. Whole classes failed. When they did that, they actually mobilized the entire school generation because it represented everything that the oppressor stood for. This was a battle we had to fight.
At 8:15 in the morning, and precisely according to plan, students simultaneously marched out of 5 schools in Soweto, intending to protest the Afrikaans issue in a mass meeting at the Orlando football stadium.
We had hundreds, probably thousands, of school kids. And we thought we know everything there is to know about managing protests. The first thing we're worried about is that everyone must be accounted for at all times. So we then had chains of 5 kids. And make sure you're holding somebody's hand all the time. If not holding somebody's hand, get worried, because where is your partner?
Then it became really a torrent, a sea of young black faces. And at that point, the police tried to stop the march from going on to Orlando Stadium.
I've never seen that many police. And you didn't only have police at that time, you had the defense force. So you actually had the army. I mean, there's a group of kids with shining black shoes and little white socks and teeny little tunics. And they're singing freedom songs, holding one another. We actually looked cute. It's unbelievable to think that anyone could have stood firm on their feet and actually shot into that crowd.
Your initial thought is to secure yourself, and then you look around you. You see girls running, screaming.
We had hundreds of school kids running helter-skelter, running all over the place. We had planned for water pipes, we had planned for maybe rubber bullets. We had not planned or thought that it's possible that people were actually going to be killed on that day.
The teeming black township of Soweto has finally erupted into the violence that whites have been fearing for years. At least 2 of the dead fell when police opened fire on a crowd.
I don't know why they decided to shoot. I can only think it was black life and it didn't count. Life of African people had always been cheap.
The mayhem went all over Soweto. The following day it went on all over the country. And really South Africa was on fire.
Here in Durban, 3 police baton charges were needed to break up a 2,000-strong demonstration at Claremont Native Township.
It was like a country at war. And I never forget listening to my radio as the demonstrations were spreading like a prairie fire, and it occurred to me that the regime that we thought was powerful seemed to be terribly disorganized, panicking.
Since June the 16th, when South African troops and police opened fire on a peaceful school children's demonstration, the white government has presided over the largest massacre of its black population since South Africa came into existence.
When you see your friends being shot at for just walking in the street, it does something to you. And therefore you would look around. What are the alternatives? Do I become like my mother, forever be under the yoke of apartheid? And the alternative was
for me to not be like my mom, great as she was, but to go and fight.
Information kept on coming through the prison walls about what was going on. The significance of the 1976 uprising was that the government actually produced one of the most rebellious generation of African youth. They were very militant, they were very brave, and there is nothing as encouraging to a prisoner than to know that the ideas for which you are suffering will never die.
1976 was the turning point. Black people had made up their mind. We're not taking this anymore. And South Africa was never the same again.
When we return, Nelson Mandela's release after 27 years behind bars. You're listening to an NPR News special, Remembering the Life of Nelson Mandela. In 1964, Nelson Mandela was sent to South Africa's Robben Island prison to serve a life sentence. 2 decades later, Mandela had become a worldwide symbol from behind bars and a growing problem for South Africa's white minority government. It was the beginning of the end for the institution of apartheid.
They sing of the man they regard as their leader, the jailed nationalist Nelson Mandela. Show us the way to victory, say the words. Freedom is in your hands.
Sometimes I think the fact that he was in prison and could make no speeches and therefore could make no mistakes is as if the government had done us a favor by locking him up all those many years.
It made this a worldwide phenomenon.
Hello.
Can I help you?
Yes, I'm calling from Holland. I'd like to speak to Mrs. Mandela, please.
Peter.
I'm calling from the Dutch radio.
Yes.
Winnie Mandela is her husband's voice in the world outside. The government has tried to silence her. For nearly 20 years, she has been living under virtual house arrest.
Your husband has been in prison now for 22 years. It is incredible that he is still the most popular leader in South Africa.
He is a symbol of the aspirations of the black people of this country.
In the early 80s, the world, in some sense, became obsessed by this political prisoner.
50,000 birthday cards from the people of Holland were delivered to Nelson Mandela's wife, Winnie. World champion boxer Mike Tyson sent his gloves for Mandela.
I think the government was always terrified that he'd die in prison. They were between a rock and a hard place. If he died in prison, not only would he be a martyr, but I think they feared that the world would believe they'd bumped him off, that they'd assassinated him in some way. On the other hand, they were afraid to let him out because they didn't know what would happen.
After months of brutal infighting, President P.W. Botha was forced from office today in a dramatic cabinet coup. It was a rainy, gloomy day in Cape Town as the man who was head of state here for 11 years was made to step down. Botha's successor, F.W. de Klerk, and his associates are faced with convincing a skeptical international community that they have policies for South Africa which will forever bury the concept of apartheid.
Before I became president, in the latter part of the 80s, the options were limited. One option was a military option. Hard fist, continue, hold on to power, suppress. Another option would be to string things out, to negotiate, but really not to negotiate. To give in a little bit here, do a little thing there, and to just stretch it out.
He knew perfectly well he could stay in power. With the army and the police, you can carry on for quite a long time if you're prepared to shoot, to use violence if necessary. But I don't think de Klerk was prepared to shoot.
Mandela!
Ladies and gentlemen, I give you the state president.
The opening speech in the beginning of the year 1919 was the most well-kept secret in my whole political career.
Our country and all its people have been embroiled in conflict, tension, and violent struggle for decades. Today, I'm able to announce far-reaching decisions. The steps that have been decided are the following. The prohibition of the African National Congress, the Pan-Africanist Congress, the South African Communist Party, and a number of subsidiary organizations is being rescinded.
It was a total stunning shock. They didn't know it. This was going to happen.
I wish to put it plainly that the government has taken a firm decision to release Mr. Mandela unconditionally. I am serious about bringing this matter to finality without delay. The time for negotiation has arrived.
If I may, I'd like to recap what we've just heard from President de Klerk. He has announced that at 3 p.m. tomorrow, Johannesburg time, Nelson Mandela will finally be released after 27 years behind bars.
When F.W. de Klerk made that speech, he believed that if you released Mandela, who'd become an icon in prison, a living martyr, if you released him, he would quickly be shown to be fallible. Old, out of touch, demythologized was the word they used. And all this was wrong.
You join us at the Victor Verster prison where the excitement is running high. People halfway up trees, standing on their toes, clinging to the wires, trying to get the best possible view any moment now. If we can just spot Mr. Mandela. There's Mr. Mandela, Mr. Nelson Mandela, the free man taking his first steps into a new South Africa. And a salute from Mr. Nelson Mandela, his wife Winnie, greeting the people, his first public appearance in nearly three decades, 72 years old, walking strongly, step by step. And one wonders what must be passing through Mr. Mandela's mind at this moment.
When I saw that crowd, I must confess that I didn't have the courage and the confidence, you know, to speak to them. I never imagined that there would be such crowds. Rather took me by surprise. I think it took more than an hour for us just to go through the crowd to be able to go to the platform.
Today, the majority of South Africans, black and white, recognize that apartheid has no future.
For the first time in 78 years, the African National Congress is talking to the white minority government. Its leader, Nelson Mandela, publicly welcomed by the president who freed him less than 3 months ago.
We are here as fellow South Africans, convinced that the system of white minority rule must come to an end without delay.
From the early 60s, in the minds of most of the whites of this country, Mandela was simply regarded as a terrorist. And now I must sit with his men around a table.
To start negotiations with a government which had throughout the years repeated that they would never sit down and talk to a terrorist organization was a highly sensitive matter.
When we started negotiations, Mr. Mandela his very first opening statement, for at least 20 minutes or more, he made a study of the Afrikaner history, merely telling us, look, I know you, and I respect what you've gone through. He didn't come up with a statement of bitterness, retribution. No. A man, after 27 years of being robbed of his freedom, and to then come forward and start negotiations on that basis, remarkable. There's no way you can argue against that.
After 3 days of historic discussions, first President de Klerk and then Mr. Mandela appeared to face the press together, their handshake evidence of the progress made.
It didn't come easily. We had breakdowns, we had setbacks, people would storm out of meetings, but things seemed to be going well until fairly early in 1992, we had total breakdown.
Good evening. Prospects for peace are fading. At least 31 people have died since violence erupted in Soweto yesterday.
The most powerful image of violence in South Africa is no longer a confrontation between black and white, but between black and black.
The more conservative Zulus, led by Chief Gotcha Buthelezi, challenged Mandela's right to speak for all blacks. Blacks are killing blacks in a steadily worsening tribal war.
The military security forces and the police were engaged in this. They were providing weapons. They organized raids. They constituted what Mandela called a third force.
I can no longer explain to our people why we continue to talk to a government which is murdering our people.
That war between the Zulu tribe and left-wing blacks has become a lot deadlier in recent days, and that is bound to make whites in this country even more anxious. Widespread violence to go with their now uncertain political and economic future.
The whites simply were afraid of giving up the power that they had, that they exercised for more than 300 years. And they could see this slipping out of their hands. And some of the right-wingers, the white right-wing, tried to derail the process.
Approximately 10:25 this morning, Mr. Hani drove up to his house, got out, shots were fired by a white man at close range.
Chris Hani was the head of Mkhonto we Sizwe, the armed wing of the ANC, immensely popular person. He would draw the biggest crowd of any leader in the country, Mandela included.
I'm unfortunate to announce that Mr. Hani has been killed instantly.
When he was shot down after he'd been out jogging, there was an extraordinary eruption of anger in the country. That was the most terrible moment.
There have been numerous incidents of rioting and other violence. And to report on the situation in Durban, we have Dirk Dippenaar reporting from a portable phone.
In Durban, I'm in the city centre, and it is a riot. The police have now cocked their rifles. The mob is starting to run back. There's chaos in the centre of Durban right now. Hundreds of policemen are coming out. They've got bulletproof vests on. An ANC marshal.
Hello, Dirk.
President de Klerk and the government realized that they were now powerless to control the situation. And that very night, Mandela went on television to appeal to the country for calm.
We say to all South Africans, black and white, this killing must stop. Our pain and anger is real. Yet we must not permit ourselves to be provoked by those who seek to deny us the very freedom Chris Hani gave his life for.
It was his intervention on television that kept the country calm. That night, effectively, Mandela became president of the country.
On the final day of campaigning in South Africa's non-racial election, a huge explosion has caused death and injury near the Johannesburg offices of the African National Congress.
No one has claimed responsibility, but it's assumed to be the work of the far right, which has threatened to disrupt the election. The effect of this kind of action may well be to deter people from voting.
It was a very explosive situation right in the final days of the transition. I mean, nothing in South Africa has ever been dull. We went to the brink several times, but there was no way of going backwards.
It's 7 o'clock on the morning of the 27th of April 1994. Polling stations have opened and thousands of people queue up to cast their vote at ballot stations. And we see that Mr. Mandela is busy casting his vote at this moment.
Vote ANC for peace in our land. Now is the time. Vote Mandela for president. Vote ANC.
In many black and coloured areas, queues began forming at 4 o'clock this morning as first-time voters streamed to the polls. Thousands of people were already queuing before 7 o'clock outside polling stations at Soshanguve near Pretoria and at Soweto. The Red Cross said people should wear a hat, take a bottle of water, a snack and some boiled sweets in case of long delays.
Yeah, well, it was a crazy day. To think, I mean, that I had to wait until I was 62 years of age. Nelson Mandela was 76 years of age before we voted in the land of our birth.
A man of 101 years old voted for the first time at Addo in the Eastern Cape last night. Although unable to say much, the man appeared jubilant.
It just was overwhelming to see all these people in long queues who couldn't even complete their voting in the one day. It had to continue the next day. And we're prepared to stand there in the sun and rain and to travel miles to go and put an X against a name. And I wondered to myself, what is it about casting a vote?
I, Nelson Rolihlahla Mandela, do hereby swear to be faithful to the Republic of South Africa.
Huge crowds. The day when Nelson Mandela was inaugurated, the first democratically elected president of South Africa.
And to devote myself to the well-being of the Republic and all its people.
Will you please raise your right hand and say, "So help me God."
So help me God.
And you sat there and looked at the benches of the newly elected legislators, and there were all these terrorists as they had been regarded by the former apartheid government, and there they were sitting. Many had been on Robben Island, many had been tortured, and many of us kept having to pinch ourselves to say, "No, man, I'm dreaming."
On that day, everyone who was at the inauguration will admit that the most exciting thing of that day was when the jets, just at the right time, they flew over the crowd. I think it was just the idea of people suddenly realizing in mass that those are now ours. They don't belong to the white apartheid regime anymore. They belong to us, to all the people. We are the government.
Nelson Mandela was president from 1994 until 1999. After leaving office, he worked to promote peace around the world and end the scourge against HIV/AIDS. He lived his remaining years with his third wife, Grace Michelle, near Johannesburg. You've been listening to Mandela, an audio history produced by Joe Richman and Sue Johnson of Radio Diaries, with help from Ben Shapiro and Deborah George. For more information about Mandela's life and legacy, visit mandelahistory.org. Vulcani This has been an NPR News special, remembering the life of Nelson Mandela.